Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
TikTok for Business is helping owners like you reach new customers every day.
We saw up to a 10x return on our TikTok shop ads. A few years ago, I started sharing my love for fashion on social media and Willow Boutique was born. We're not just a place to shop, we've really become a community. TikTok allows us to find more people to have that great experience. I cannot imagine my business without TikTok. It's completely changed my life and I could not be happier.
Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.
All right, here we are Wednesday, November 19th, and get out the parkway today. Get your po' boy to benefit the Al Copeland Foundation. You can skip the line if you, I'll give you the address and all that stuff in a little bit. But head on out there, you can do some good for that. We are going to talk about, the fog, by the way, is out there, southbound convoy on the causeway, and just be careful because it's the kind of thing where, you know, you can be driving around saying, fog, what the heck are you talking about, fog? There's no fog, and then you go somewhere else and you can't see a foot in front of you. So be careful. Text us if you can safely about any specific conditions that are terrible. Fog is thick between Ponchatoula and I-55. A text comes in. Steve Melnick joins us now, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's done research into strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurements, and supply chain design. And we love talking to him about EVs, electric vehicles. Good morning, professor. How are you?
Good morning. Fairly well. Thank you very much.
Tell me what the situation is. First of all, let's take a large overview picture of the EV market in the United States and what it looks like.
The EV market in the United States is really one that's in flux. Let me tell you why. Overall, what's happening is there's confusion because of the fact that in the past we've had incentives being provided by the government in order to encourage people to go to EVs. With the big, beautiful bill and Trump's recent decisions, those incentives have gone away. We've also got strategic fluctuation from the companies. You've got companies like GM and Tesla who are deciding, like in the case of GM, there's really confusion as to what they're going to do. Are they going to focus on EVs? Are they not going to focus on EVs? Are they going to make investments? And this is taking place at a time where the Chinese are controlling, A, one of the largest markets for EVs, and number two, where they control all of the resources that you need in building an EV. They control battery production. They control raw rare earth minerals. They control a lot of the chip production. So what you've got going on is you've got a period of high uncertainty. And this is a critical point for American industry. If we don't manage this period of high uncertainty well, it may realistically be in the next 10 years, we may be no longer a global player in the auto industry, but a regional player in the auto industry who's very strong in North America, somewhat strong in Latin America, limited presence in Europe, very limited presence in countries like India and China.
How much of a global presence are we now?
Well, we are a fairly big presence. You've got companies like Tesla. Tesla, overall, is one of the top manufacturers of EVs. So in the United States, it's the largest manufacturer, but its market share has been decreasing over time.
Can I ask you, Professor, if I might jump in for a second?
Sure.
Who else makes EVs? Because I see, I think it's Rivian or something like that. What's the name of it?
Okay. Rivian.
I see those. And then I rode in one of them in a hotel car in Washington, D.C., and I forgot the name of that one. But I'm just wondering who the major manufacturers are, because I don't see a lot of them here in this area other than Tesla and maybe a Rivian every now and then.
A Rivian is one of the majors. And then you've got the fact that GM is one of the major manufacturers, as is Ford. For example, GM has been very successful in EVs, but they've been successful in the upscale market. Mm-hmm. If you look at some of their, if you look at the Lyriq, for example, from Cadillac, that car has gotten enormous reviews because it's well engineered, got a decent range, and it offers a level of luxury, but then it's a high-end car. So, and then you've got Ford. Ford has made fairly major investments. In addition to Tesla and Rivian, you've probably also seen cars like the Ford Lightning, the Ford Lightning F-150, the Mach-E, which is Ford's Mustang, which has been electrified. And again, in the case of GM, one of the major products GM offers is the Bolt, which is a basically not a very sophisticated, but it's a critical product because it's in the low price market. If you're offering Cadillacs, which are over $60,000, $70,000, that's not going to give you long-term success. And if you look at what the Chinese are doing, they're doing exactly what Henry Ford did when he went into the auto industry. What he did is he didn't go after the high-end people. He went in with the Model T. What we need right now from companies like GM and for Ford, I'm not going to talk about Stellantis because Stellantis is somewhat confusing. Mm-hmm. Toyota, Subaru, they're doing a joint platform, but they're still not a major player. Nissan has some capability.
What about Lucid?
Lucid is another one, yeah. But the Lucid, Fisk has gone away. Let me just take a look. So essentially,
I know I rode in a Lucid is the car I rode in, and it amazed me, Professor, what a smooth ride it was. I guess maybe because it was so heavy. I don't know.
Okay, the major car, let me give you an idea who the major manufacturer, who was involved in this marketplace, okay?
Okay.
You've got Tesla, you've got Rivian, you've got General Motors, you've got Lucid, Ford, you've got BMW. One of the major players is Volkswagen.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, have you ever had a chance to see the I grew up in the 70s and 60s.
Yes. You're talking about the van?
Yes.
I think that's awesome. I would love to have one of those. I really would.
Yeah,
but that begs the question. We got to take a break here. We'll answer it when we come back. What does all of this uncertainty mean for people that already own one or are thinking of buying one? Because if every resource that we need to make these or maintain them, or especially when it comes to replacing batteries, come from China, what kind of uncertainty does that lead to? Because we're not talking about buying a shirt here or a suit, right? We're talking about a major capital investment in a vehicle that can cost upwards of...
Yeah, it can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, so there you go. You want to make sure before you buy it that you'll be able to maintain it or that you don't wind up with a literal white elephant. 620 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, spending an hour talking about EVs with Steve Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's done research in strategic supply chain cybersecurity performance measurements and supply chain design. So if somebody's going out today, professor, looking for a car and they're thinking, maybe I'll look into this EV thing. First of all, I guess the ride is because of the weight of the vehicle. That's why it rides so smoothly.
Well, it is, but you have to understand. Okay, first of all, the reason it rides so smooth is because of the nature of the power delivery. EVs basically give you a linear power delivery. If you think about getting into your ICE car, and you turn the engine on and you have a transmission, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you feel when the transmission shifts? In most cars, you can.
Right.
In an EV, you don't. It's a linear flow.
Uh-huh.
So So you're not going jump, jump, jump. You're going straight on. Secondly, because of the weight of it, remember, most of the weight's going to be in the battery, and EVs are traditionally heavier than ordinary cars, than ICE cars. It's going to give you a much more solid ride.
Solid would be a good way to put it. It felt as though it was hugging the ground, if that makes sense. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, okay. In fact, that's one of the reasons I like driving German cars. I like the fact that when I drive it, I feel as if I'm connected to the ground.
Exactly.
And the other thing it gives you, too, is for those of us who occasionally like it, it's a blast because of acceleration. Mm. I mean, one of the things people note is that if you get into an EV like a Tesla and you go into some of their very fast modes, you can go from 0 to 60 in under 4 seconds.
Wow.
Those are nice features. But on the other hand, you've got some things going against it. Number one, the initial cost. It's going to be higher. Number two, the technology. The technology, this is a product which is in the early stages of development in the product life cycle, which means there's uncertainty over which technology is going to win. And that technology really applies to the batteries. And the third area that you've got to deal with is you've got to deal with the, what I call, infrastructure issues. Do we have enough EVs? If I buy an ICE, I'm always assured that I can go anywhere in the country and find a gas station. If I buy an EV, I may not be able to get an EV charging station. And once I get it, I've got two other issues. Speed, how long is it going to take me to charge? And also availability. What I mean by that is somebody did a test where they drove across the United States in a EV, and they found that they could, in many cases, get access to EV charging stations, but often the EV charging stations were down.
Hmm.
So it's like going to a gas station and having the person look at you and say, "Darn, you can't pump gas today." And then the final factor you've got to worry about, and this is one that you're not worried about, but I'm worried about because I live in Michigan, mm-hmm. and I go occasionally to Canada. Cold weather approach.
Mm.
EVs suffer badly. If the weather gets cold, you can lose 30% of your range.
Really?
So you put those issues together, and for many people, it's number one, a major investment. Number two, it's an expensive investment. And number three, if I'm not going to tend to buy an EV. If I'm smart, I'm going to lease an EV. And why do I want to lease it? Because at the end of the lease, I just simply hand it back. So the person who's leasing the car to me is responsible.
Let me pick it up when we come back right there, Professor. It makes sense to lease, not to buy. We're talking about EVs, spending an hour. We'll get back to China. And if you own one right now, what about when it comes time for a new battery, et cetera? 6:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:45, quarter to 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Professor Stephen Melnick, Professor of Supply Chain Management at Michigan State. He is our EV go-to guy. So somebody texted in, Professor, and this goes to what you said before about leasing the vehicle as opposed to buying them because of the battery life. And they said, and this apparently is an EV owner, that the batteries last 300,000 miles. Okay, this thing with these batteries lasts 300,000 miles or more. Nobody keeps their car that long in the first place. But is it about mileage or is it about time? Or how does it work with these batteries?
Okay. No, it's technology.
Okay.
Okay, let me give you the idea. First of all, you've asked a really interesting question about leasing. One of the problems is, ideally, because this is a product where the technology is changing very quickly, mm-hmm. One of the things you don't want to do is you don't want to buy it. You want to lease it because you don't want to be the person that's responsible for absorbing the cost. You don't want to be the person who's got a Betamax system when everyone goes to VHS. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be that person. The problem that you have is that the depreciation rates on EVs are extraordinarily higher than they are on ICE cars and on hybrids. For example, on average, an EV depreciates almost 60% in 5 years versus an ICE, which depreciates about 46%, and a hybrid, which is about 41%, which means, guess what? because of the high depreciation, which is going to be factored in. So it's the issue is the person who's leasing me the car is going to have to charge me for that. So what's going to affect the EV leasing? It's going depreciation. It's going to be the rapid technology advancements. It's going to be battery life. And it's not simply battery life. It's replacement cost. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, you can have a battery that lasts 300,000 miles, but if I have to replace it, in many cases, it's almost as much as replacing the car. You've also got the issue that it depends upon the models. Some products have a very good depreciation rate, others not so good. And it's also influenced by the fact that the infrastructure is, you know, where you're located in terms of infrastructure. So your listener is correct, but it's only one factor. Mm-hmm. So the result of which is, guess what? I want to lease it, but because of these factors, I'm going to wind up paying more in lease payments because the person leasing it to me knows that the vehicle that he or she gets back within 3 years or 5 years is worth no more. It's worth far less than competitive vehicles for ICE and for hybrids. So guess who's going to have to pay for that difference? So you're right. Go on.
When it comes to the battery, is it all or nothing at all? Do they slow down or is it like the battery when it's kaput, it's kaput?
Well, it's many things. First of all, we've talked about this before, but let's look at the battery. You've got a battery pack. Mm-hmm. Number one is the technology. If the technology shifts away from the current method of charging, et cetera, you may not find people being, it may be more difficult to get it serviced, to get it, or more difficult to use it. Over time, batteries kind of degrade. If you've ever noticed something on your computer, if you have a battery built into it and you've had it for a number of years, suddenly you start to find it doesn't charge as quickly. And then the third issue is when we have a problem with it, most of the time there are facilities out there that they can look at your battery pack and figure out which one of the cells they can replace. But in most cases, what we're going to do is look at the entire battery pack and say, okay, we've got a ding. I don't want to deal with it. Let's replace the whole thing. And then one more issue that you have to pick up on is we still have some concerns about safety. Batteries have been known to spontaneously combust, which is one reason that GM, with some of its car EVs, has told their users not to keep them in the garage, but to keep them outside. In Florida, when we talked about this in spring, you had discussions where, because of flooding, EVs were basically combusting because a spark that would develop in one cell would go to the others. So you put those factors together, which means, guess what? Leases are going to be high, insurance costs are going to be higher, and those are factors. So it's not simply the life of the battery, it's all the other factors. You just can't look at one issue in isolation.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, and we'll talk about if China has everything that's needed for electric vehicles, how the United States can ever compete with them when it comes to EVs, other than keeping them out of this country, but that doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the world. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:56 and a half, couple of minutes left with Stephen Melnick, Tommy Tucker, WWL here. He's a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's our go-to guy. He's done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurement, supply chain design. So, professor, if China's got everything needed to construct or maintain EVs, correct me if I'm saying anything wrong here.
Yep.
How does the United States compete with that? And although we may control the import of cheap Chinese EVs here, what does that mean worldwide? Because we can't control that, can we?
No, we can't. And in fact, I think we are at a fork in the road. Do you remember Yogi Berra? He once had a great statement. He said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it.
Mm-hmm.
We're on that fork. The auto industry is at that fork in the road. Why? Because we have a decision. What are we going to do in the future? Right now, we're not doomed. We're not in the great spot either. And the reason we're not in the great spot is because while we're competitive at home and in certain segments, primarily the luxury market, we're really behind China in terms of cost, scale, and supply chain control. They can succeed. GM, Ford, et cetera, can succeed. But they have to treat EVs as a separate full business. Right now, it's an add-on. It's something we do in addition to ICE. It's got to be allowed to develop as its own initiative, as its own vehicle, as its own brand, as its own identity. To give you an idea, in Europe, there was a guy who built traditional ovens, stoves, and he was the market leader. And he decided that the future was not traditional stoves, which are becoming very, very competitive, but rather it was in convection stoves, the new technology. And his solution was to do a Cortez. What's that? When Cortez attacked the Aztecs, in order to convince the people they had to commit, he burnt the ships. And what this guy did is he sold his traditional business. Right now, what we have is we have a hybrid, and the hybrid is not succeeding. So in order to succeed, they've got to, number one, do what they're doing. Protect the home market while using it to climb the learning curve. We've got the Chinese have a phenomenally competitive, active market. It is so competitive in China where right now innovation and cost are the two major drivers. Number two, they have to build a true low-cost EV structure. We don't know, American car companies don't know how to really design effective EVs. The Farley, the CEO of Ford, compared a traditional American EV to the stuff coming out of China, and we use too much wiring. We have too much complexity. And number three, we've got to develop a low-cost, we've got to catch up in terms of materials and batteries. And finally, we've got to become leaders in terms of software. EVs are primarily software beds. Those are skills which are very different from what we have right now. So if we don't make the transition, the big three will become big three to North America only.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time as always. We'll be back, WWL. The fog would appear to be worsening downtown. I don't know where you are, but be careful. Remember, no bright lights. You don't want your flashers on unless you're stopped. And just drive smart. Don't be stupid. If you can't see, don't drive faster than you can stop, right? I mean, that makes common sense. It is currently 7:15, and we're joined by Jackson Kirby, Vice President of Construction for Audubon, to talk about some plans for riverfront projects to make sure they do it right. How you doing, Jackson?
I'm doing great, Tommy. Thanks for having me this morning.
Thanks for taking the time with us. Tell me about some of the projects that the Audubon Institute has already done along the riverfront, and then we'll get to what you guys were thinking about doing and where that stands.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Audubon Nature Institute's been involved in the downtown riverfront for many years, really since the construction of the Audubon Aquarium. Then we went through and we built Woldenburg Park. We were involved in the RTA terminal transformation. We've really sort of committed to this continuous riverfront park. And so currently we're working on what was the Governor Nichols Wharf Warehouse. And that location is becoming about 6.3 acres of new park space that's going to create a continuous riverfront access point all the way from like Spanish Plaza down at Canal Street to Poland Avenue at the back of the Bywater.
That's a big thing.
It is a really big thing. You know, it's going to be one of the longest contiguous riverfront parks in the nation, over 2.25 miles. We're really excited to open it up.
So tell me what happened with the expansion or changes or what's thinking you guys are thinking about holding off on. Tell me where we stand on all of that.
Well, so where we stand is the piece of property that we're developing into park space was originally two different wharf warehouses. So it was the Governor Nichols Wharf and the Esplanade Wharf.
Tell me if you can, Jackson, for people that are driving around that can, in their mind, picture it. We're talking about near what streets?
Sure, yeah. If you're kind of coming down Esplanade towards the river, right where you come through the flood wall, that's right at the intersection between the Governor Nichols Wharf on your right-hand side and the Esplanade Wharf on your left-hand side.
Gotcha.
And so what's happening right now is we're redeveloping the Governor Nichols side of that wharf space. And so this is about, like I said, 6.3 acres, and it's going to be a series of lawns. It's going to have trees, a playground, a little shed. It's a really beautiful park space that's going to connect from the Moonwalk, and then you'll take a riverfront promenade all the way in front of the Esplanade building to Crescent Park. And so phase two will be the redevelopment of the Esplanade warehouse. We just haven't gotten to those plans yet.
So you would be able to go from like Waldenburg Park all the way to Crescent Park, right? When this is all done?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So you'll just kind of walk along the riverfront the entire way, and we're planting trees. So you'll have this shaded promenade that connects the entire way.
So is the project proceeding as planned or not?
It is proceeding as planned. You know, it took a long time of development. This project started in maybe 2018, 2019, and real development got delayed a little bit on account of COVID. But after that, we picked it back up. We made a plan. We've got, you know, all the funds were raised, and we are under construction. We're on schedule and on budget, and we're really excited to open the park in the spring.
So is there a distinction between phase one and phase two?
There is a distinction between the two phases. So one, like I said, is the Governor Nichols side, and then phase two will be Esplanade.
So what's going on with phase two?
Well, so phase two, you know, our primary focus is on getting the first phase at the Governor Nichols Wharf completed and ready to open in the spring. And as we're wrapping up that phase, we're certainly hearing from folks that are extremely excited to start talking about the possibilities for the next phase. And we are, too. There's some really exciting ideas out there. There is a lot on the table, but we also have a lot of work to do before anything becomes concrete. There's, you know, community engagement and fundraising and planning and permitting and, you know, all of that process that has to go on before anything happens at the Esplanade site.
So what is it going to look like in phase one? What, as people go out there to enjoy phase one, what's it going to look like? What are they going to find?
Yeah, let's take kind of like a little radio tour through it. As you walk through the flood wall at the end of Esplanade, you're walking towards the river. You kind of walk up a slight ramp. And as you get there, what you used to be confronted with was a large corrugated metal warehouse building. And we've removed about 80% of that. And so now you walk up past the loading dock and you're going to just be faced with the most beautiful view of the Mississippi River you can get from anywhere in the city. I mean, you can watch the sunrise to your left and the sun set to your right, and it's just incredible. So you walk up, there's a series of lawns to your right-hand side. One of the things that we knew when developing this park was that we needed to offer a lot of shade. You know, any park wants a lot of shade. In New Orleans, we want even more shade. So we raised the lawns about 4 feet so that we could give room to plant some really beautiful trees along the promenade, give those root systems a lot of room to really develop. So you walk over these series of elevated lawns. I think we've planted over 120 trees out there. Mm-hmm. The first lawn has some hammock posts where you can bring your own hammock and sit out and enjoy the river and your hammock. As you go back towards downtown, there's a playgrove, which has a marsh-themed playground with a speckled trout that kids can kind of climb through and over. There's an American alligator and a red-eared slider turtle that they can climb on. It's really fun. There's sort of built-in shade structures and seating for families to sit around and enjoy. And then as you continue to walk down towards downtown, you get to a larger open lawn and what we're currently calling the cultural shed, which is the remaining piece of the warehouse building. Mm-hmm. And that space has, you know, sort of like picnic table seating, I would say, throughout. Mm-hmm. A small stage that could support like a jazz trio or something in the evenings. It's got a small kitchen on the backside that can provide concessions. It's a really beautiful place for someone to be able to grab a snack and kind of sit out and watch the river. And then as you continue to go, there's kind of a planted plaza with a misting pad and some really lush, beautiful plantings, overhead catenary lights that kind of create this romantic glow. And this is the corner of the wharf that really juts right out into the Crescent. So you just feel like you're really out in the middle of the Mississippi River, catching the breeze and enjoying the connection.
That's awesome. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 7:21 traffic now, WWO. 7:27, couple of minutes left. Tommy Tucker, WWL, with Jackson Kirby, Vice President of Construction for Audubon, talking about the phase one and phase two of the riverfront development. Jackson, is one thing to build it, but any of us that have homes realize, you know, well, that sounds nice, a gazebo or a patio or whatever, but you got to maintain it. What about maintaining all of these things? Is the money there? Is the budget there? Whose responsibility is it to maintain it? And how important is that when you go about thinking of developing something like this?
Yeah, you're right. That is hugely important. And one of our project goals was to create a park with economic sustainability in mind and understanding that we do have to pay for operations. And people expect this to be a world-class park, and that doesn't come with a small price tag. So we've built in opportunities. You know, we have a food and beverage opportunity out at the cultural shed. We will rent out some spaces for events. And, you know, we understand that there has to be some revenue driven, and we have accounted for operating costs for the first few years as we kind of get that program developed and get on our feet.
This is a huge leap of faith, because basically what you're saying is if we build it, they will come, right?
You know, I think they've already come. You know, The downtown riverfront is already just such an exciting place. And I think people are there. They just need this connection that lets them really traverse the entire space.
What about public input? And if somebody has ideas, or especially as it relates to phase two, tell me about community involvement with this.
Sure. Yeah, we start all of our projects with a community engagement process where we reach out to the community, find out what their needs are. You know, that's one of the things that really shaped phase one of this project. We heard from the community that they were really looking for passive space to go enjoy the river. You know, they didn't want Ferris wheels and really overly active spaces. So this was kind of a response to that. And so we'll do a similar process once we get into planning for phase two, and we'll be looking for public comment on all of the ideas. We want everyone's best idea to bring into play out there.
I don't live there, but I disagree with the Ferris wheel. I think it would make for an awesome visual shot of the city with the lit up Crescent City connection, and like they have in different areas of the country, the giant, and the world, the giant Ferris
wheels. Sure, a lot of great cities have them.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't, but I would agree for it. Thank you, Jackson. I appreciate your time. I really do. Jackson Kirby, Vice President of Construction for Audubon. When we come back, we'll talk with Amy McCarron, newly elected council member for District A, and we'll also talk about a Scrabble tournament. So a lot coming up. Stay with us right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan here on the Big 870 WWL. 7:37, 23 till 8. There's a Scrabble tournament going on in Metairie. A fully rated 7-game North American Scrabble Players Association tournament. And we are joined now by Lindsay Crotty, organizing director, to talk about it. How you doing, Lindsay?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
You know what I found dating? I find when people say, well, what do you want to do when I go on a first date? What I want to do is play Scrabble, because I think, no, honestly, because you can find out so much about somebody just by sitting there playing, not only their choice of words and their strategy when it comes to the game, but just talking to them. You know what I'm saying? I think I love Scrabble. Tell me about the tournament.
Yeah, we are having a tournament at the East Bank Regional Library this weekend. It's relatively small, but we have two really good divisions. We're going to do a 7-game round robin. We'll be there from 9 to 5. We will also have a kids division. We're excited that, you know, the next generation is also excited to learn about, you know, one of our favorite games. It's really helping them to not only expand their vocabulary, but, you know, practice their math skills and good competition. And they also play in teams, so they're learning some teamwork as well. We are also open. We have a division for newcomers. So anyone, even if you have, you know, you're scared about using a clock, or you're scared about a real tournament rated, you know, Scrabble tournament, then we have a newcomers division that we want everyone to get a feel for what it is, and something that is unrated and untimed and very friendly. So we have a little bit of everything for everyone.
It's open to everybody. You don't have to re-qualify or anything.
Exactly. We will have a newcomers division for anyone who has not experience the Scrabble tournament before. And if you have, we have that too, and we're happy to open it to everyone.
Will you have to pass through a letter detector when you walk in to make sure you're not bringing in your own letters?
Not this weekend, no.
Okay. And everything will be furnished? All the kids got to do, or people got to do, is show up?
Just show up. I think we will have enough boards, and our local members have boards that they are bringing. And we have letters, and the library is providing extra boards and letters as well. And we will
drinks and happy to host everybody.
Do you have any referees there, or will the dictionary be the ultimate guide?
So, yeah, we have. I am technically the director. So if there are any, you know, breakout fights or arguments, I'm there to settle it using the rule book. Mm-hmm. We do have computers set up around the room so that if there is a word that is challenged, both players can go to the computer together and check it on an electronic dictionary.
What kind of player are you?
I am so good that I direct.
Okay.
Right.
Tell
if
the
I'm
truth.
Not going to win, I'm going to direct.
Tell the truth, really. Are you a good player or not?
I'm a pretty good player. I think I can be, you know, 99% of kitchen, you know, casual players. Mm-hmm. When we play in tournaments, we do have a rating, an ELO rating that follows us, just like chess. The ratings go from 0 to about 2,200. I'm rated about 1,500. My husband is rated 2,100.
Wow.
And my daughter is rated at about 1,200. So, you know, it's all in the family, and there's a level for everybody. And you're always competing against, in the tournaments, you're competing against people of your same level.
Have you ever, when somebody put down an I over an S for is, rolled your eyes and said, really?
Not at all. Sometimes okay. It's the right play to play.
Okay. Tell me how people find out more about the tournament.
Please check out NOLAScrabble.com. This will have some information for newcomers. It will also show you another tournament that we are having over Martin Luther King weekend in town, which is really popular, the Crescent City Cup. So we would love to have more players there as well.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Lindsay Crotty, organizer, director of the Scrabble Tournament, 7:42, 18 till 8. We'll talk to Amy McCarron, council member-elect for District A, when we come back here on WWL. 7:47, 13 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly to Amy McCarron, council member-elect for District A. Good morning, Ms. McCarron. How are you? And congratulations on your victory.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
And a fellow UNO alum, tell me, when you were going to Ursuline, did you ever think that you would become a city council member or not? What did you want to be when you were a kid?
No. No, when I was a kid, I thought I was going to be in musical theater. I went to NOCA for that.
Mm-hmm.
No, I had no idea. And then I worked in restaurants for a really long time before getting into financial advising. So, yeah, it's been a long journey, but this is, you know, I feel most at home in public service. So I'm really, really excited to serve the residents.
Having had a kid that went to Ursuline and was in theater, what was your leading role? Do you remember some of the roles you played?
Yes, my leading role was actually, it wasn't at Ursuline, but it was at St. Luke's Methodist Church in Lakeview. I was Peter Pan my senior year, so that was my starring role.
Been to the shows there, done that, I guarantee you. Let's talk about a budget geek, a self-proclaimed budget geek. How'd you become a budget geek, and how important is that as you look forward to assuming the duties of council member for District A?
So I have over a decade of financial experience. I was a financial advisor before I started working with Joe, which is why he approached me about coming to help him run the budget committee. So it's really important, obviously, going forward, because we are in a budget mess. I've already started getting briefings on what's going on and what's happening for this year's budget and what's happening for next year's budget. And it's vitally important that we have somebody that has that financial background to go on the council and help out and see how we can move through this mess over the next few years.
What do you think is going to be the biggest challenge as you get ready to assume the role? I hate to say role because it's not an act, but you know what I'm saying.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, look, the biggest challenge is that we are going to have to make some very tough decisions on how we move forward with funding different departments. You know, we've got to get our revenue generating departments. We've got to get them up and running. Like safety and permits is not working right now. And that is an opportunity for us to collect revenue better. So we've got to make sure that they're funded. We've got to make sure that we are not losing basic services for residents, that we're getting their streetlights fixed still. We're getting the street work done. I mean, we've got a lot of tough choices, but I think, you know, with a united council and administration, I feel very good about going forward that we are going to be able to do that without having to put stress on the residents.
Joe's a friend. Did he ever warn you about what you're about to get into or not?
Of course. Yeah, he did. He did. You know, he was a mentor and a friend, and he's like, you know, this is crazy. We had a conversation yesterday and, you know, we were just talking through the budget stuff and he's like, this is going to be tough, but he knows that I'm up for the challenge. You know, he and I were both past presidents of the Young Leadership Council. And I think that's kind of where that mentorship and friendship came from. And he's, you know, he knows I'm the right person for it. So.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Amy McCarron, council member elect for District A. It seems like a no-nonsense council member, and that's what we need right now. 10 till 8, traffic, WWL. 7:57, Tommy Tucker, WWL. A couple of minutes left with Amy McCarron, council member elect for District A. I'm asking people, Amy, where the most persistent or permanent pothole is, a problematic pothole is in.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday because right now Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Black Friday? More like Black Friday, yay! Shop the DSW Black Friday sale and take 30% off almost all the shoes, accessories, and giftable goodies we've got at DSW.com. Plus 30% off just about every regular price item at your DSW store. Score shoes that get you and everyone on your list at prices that get your budget. So carpe the deal. Head to Designer Shoe Warehouse and get that gift list done. DSW, let us surprise you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
In the city, do you have any nominees?
We have a lot of nominees in District A. I know Uptown, we've got a couple sinkholes. I know Lakeview has been struggling. Holly Grove has some bad ones. I mean, it is all over the place, really, Tommy.
I think we should have gone by neighborhood instead of by potholes now that I think about it. So you've been involved with Joe for his tenure. You know where the skeletons are buried. What is, when it comes to the cutbacks that are needed, what is it likely to look like for your fellow citizens of New Orleans next year in 2026?
Well, look, I know that Joe and Mayor-elect Moreno have been working hard with the current administration on figuring out how that looks. I mean, we are trying
Wait, hang on. You've been working on that as well. Now, come on.
I have been working on it as well. Yes,
yeah, okay.
Yes, I've been working on it as well. I had a long conversation yesterday. Look, we are trying to avoid cutting basic services, but we also have to look at, and this is something I talked about on the campaign trail a lot, there are certain things where we are, like, for example, our electricians, we just have two electricians that work for City Hall. So we're spending a lot of money on outside contracts for that kind of thing. And those are some creative ways that we can use the budget by lowering those costs to the city, by having in-house workforce to do those things. And then it makes residents, it gets things done faster, and we're using the budget more wisely. So there's going to be some things, there's going to be cuts, of course, in departments, but there are also some creative ways that I think we really need to look at in every department on how we are looking at outside contracts versus inside employees.
If after 4 years you decide to run again, what will you be saying? What will you hope you'll be able to say is your biggest accomplishment?
Well, what I hope we've gotten out of this budget deficit, and that we are really working towards getting our streets fixed and providing the basic services for residents, and we're keeping people here.
My advice to you would be to spend as much time with your husband as you can and your kids as you can before you're sworn in.
Yes, agreed. I'm working hard to do that.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. We'll talk to you, I know, I'm sure, throughout your tenure. Amy
yes,
McCarron, you bet, council member-elect for District A. We'll take a break. We come back, got a big hour for you. We're talking to Ronald Surpass, take a deep dive into crime, talk about borders, patrol, and customs. And they're coming into the New Orleans area. We'll talk with Justin Kennedy from Parkway. Today's Wednesday. And then we'll talk to Dane Cialino about AI and the law. Wednesday morning, November 19th, a little bit more than a week away from Thanksgiving. Doesn't feel like it. Foggy out. Be careful about that. It is coming up on 8:15. And we're joined by Ronald Surpass, as we are every Wednesday morning, a professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, Washington State Police superintendent, Nashville City Police Chief, and a lifelong police officer. How you doing, sir? Good morning.
I'm great, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right. Let's talk about these immigration sweeps, or the arrival of, what is it, Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol. They've been around for a long time, correct?
Right. The Customs Office, which predates CBP, which was a result of 2001, has been here. There's a building on Canal Street, and the name of it's the Customs House, right? So it's part of the federal government for generations, particularly around port cities. After 2001, they've made some changes. So now you have ICE, the ICE division, you have Homeland Safety, security investigators, and you have CBP. Each and every one of them have different positions and duties, and sometimes they overlap. In the case of CBP officers in any of our cities, and you know, and I've talked about this before, if I was the chief, I would expect to be able to speak to people and understand strategies and tactics so that we don't cross purposes and that we don't cause any disruption to either's operations. And ultimately, two facts can exist at the same time. One, the federal government doesn't have to ask anybody to enforce federal law, as far as I know. And two, local police always have a responsibility to make sure nobody gets hurt, be they an agent, be they a citizen, be they an illegal immigrant, or be they a legal immigrant. So that's really kind of what the parameters are.
How important is the communication factor there? Because I'm thinking you could have maybe a ICE agent grab somebody that maybe NOPD or state police or somebody else was investigating, and then before you know it, all of that's compromised.
Well, I think absolutely. That's a term called deconfliction on known investigations and known investigative targets. Now, this is going to shock some of the listeners, but it is very true that people who are engaged in criminal activity, A, tend to be a very small number of people, B, are criminally oriented, and C, may have a whole list of criminal activities to include illegal immigration or failing to follow a final order of deportation or just robbing people. So the fact that this small population of co-offending criminals could include illegal immigrants is absolutely normal, expected, and understood. Therefore, deconfliction is important.
So what would be the first step with the arrival, or should steps be taken now before they even get here with, okay, what are you guys going to be doing? What are we going to do this? How can we that, et cetera?
I would hope and expect that some of that's happened. I do know that I remember reading in the paper not long ago, Superintendent Kirkpatrick mentioned that she was working or looking forward to working with the National Guard on any deployment they would have. Those deployments come differently in different time, but the CBP investigators, the Homeland Safety Security Officer investigators, they work with local police all the time, much more fluid. So I would hope that those kinds of things would be simply a phone call. Hey, y'all are coming? Yeah. Well, let's talk about deconfliction. And remember, Tommy, that would be the most important thing to me. Only a handful of people repeat criminal offend. Some of them are U.S. citizens. Some of them are illegal immigrants. Some of them are legal immigrants. It's a very small population that will cross over among each other. So deconfliction among local, state, and federal makes a lot of sense.
I remember years ago, Border Patrol used to have these green and white cars. You remember that?
Yeah, I do. I think I still see pictures of them,
And I remember my daddy had a gas station, he used to come in there and they'd service them. That's how I first became familiar with this. How has that whole agency changed? Take me through the evolution of that, if you will. You mentioned 2001 with Customs and then Border Patrol and then ICE. Take me through the evolution of that, if you would.
So So Customs Border Patrol sounds like what it is. It was originally the customs function, which involved, you know, we had officers in the middle of the 80s leave the NOPD to go work for customs. Some were pilots, others did other things. They were investigators for customs, things that were coming in through ports of entry. Border Patrol is traditionally what's always been upon the border. So in a very loose definition, those two agencies were combined. Mm-hmm. Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE, is a bit more towards that part of the spectrum, which involves investigating those persons who are here on deportation orders or those persons who are violating the criminal law or the civil law of entering the country without authority, because they both can exist at the same time, but they're both laws. So CBP, Customs Border Patrol, has probably, let's say it's this way, maybe a more uniform function at the ports of entry. It made sense to combine them two because customs agents used to be the ones at ports of entry to go walk on the big container ships on the river, make sure the bills of lading were correct, make sure there was no, you know, nothing being smuggled. Border Patrol was typically along the border. Those two functions essentially work together now. And then Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE, that has a lot more to do with some of the criminal activity that's related to people.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I got a lot of other questions. If y'all have any, text them in to 504-260-1870. We're talking with our friend Ronald Serpas, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, about the arrival of ICE and what it could look like in New Orleans after they finish up at Charlotte and after they, I think, just left Chicago. We'll take a break, come back. Traffic now, WWL. 8:25 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Ronald Serpas, talking about Border Patrol and ICE and customs and coming to New Orleans on maybe December 1st. Chief, do you know, somebody texted in, why do they wear masks when they go out? Do you have any idea why they do that?
Publicly reported is that with the changes in social media and cell phones in everybody's hands, there's examples of people who disagree with the practice that the federal government's doing of taking pictures of those officers and doxing them, a familiar phrase for exposing them and their families to the public. I'm going to be honest with you, as a retired police officer and a family member who has members of the New Orleans Police Department who are still active, putting people in danger on either side of the equation is absolutely the wrong thing to do. So young people running around taking videos and putting those pictures on the internet and looking up who those people's family members are, what a cowardly way to say, I don't like what the police are doing, I don't like what the feds are doing, so I'm going to go embarrass that person's family. I'm going to go put their children's safety at risk by putting their family on the internet. It's despicable. It's absolutely despicable. So they wear the mask to protect their face from vision.
What are your thoughts on a consent decree ending, and would anything that Border Patrol, ICE, whatever, however you want to refer to it, is doing, would that conflict with the consent decree as it's in place now?
A, I always supported the consent decree. I've always expected the NOPD to come out of it. I'm excited for the NOPD's future that they'll be out from the consent decree. And no, constitutionally enforcing the law is what the consent decree was all about.
So when it comes to what people see and sometimes take offense to, where, I don't know, does it come to probable cause? Take me through the law enforcement aspect of Border Patrol arriving, hopping out of a van, going to a group of people, and then tell me what happens from there and where is the constitutional part of that, or where would people get mistaken and think it's unconstitutional?
I think people who get mistaken are the ones who don't understand it to begin with, and there's very little you can tell them to change their mind because it's an ideology, it's a political statement, and that's fine. I get that. But basically, you have limited number of agents and officers who are looking for very small numbers, but could be thousands in a city, of people who are already have a deportation order that they got to go, have a crime that they've been arrested for or convicted for. You're generally going to start there first because that's the easiest people to identify. Now, what happens, and especially in some of these videos we see, what has happened and has been reported is that I'm an ICE agent and I'm coming after Tommy. Mm-hmm. And Tommy's got serious problems. And when I get to Tommy, friends of Tommy get in between me and getting to Tommy. Those people who are not illegal immigrants, however, have broken the law of obstructing my investigation and arrest of someone who has an order of deportation or a warrant. That's where you see these other people getting dragged in. No pun intended. They're getting dragged into the videos, that are getting dragged into the pictures. And then some part of the media will say, look at these innocent people being arrested by the feds. It might happen, but more likely it's that somebody interfered with the feds doing what they were doing with someone who was a target that had orders of deportation or warrants. Those explain general concepts. Are there exceptions to each of those? Of course. But by and large, why would you go fishing for bass when you know you can catch catfish, right? You just go fish for catfish instead of bass.
Well, I think some people would say you just cast, like the menhaden industry, where you just cast a wide net and you get some people caught up or some things caught up in the catch that you don't necessarily want. Should people that are of brown skin or people that speak Spanish or that are here legally be concerned with ICE coming to town?
I think that anyone who's confronted by a federal agent or a law enforcement agent, be they white, brown, black, legal or illegal, has a responsibility to answer legally authorized questions and do so in a way with the least amount of drama between the two of them so it de-escalates, right? We train police officers to de-escalate circumstances with people they have a right to ask questions of. Be you legal, illegal, had a gun in your hand, pulled a robbery, the police still offer the opportunity to de-escalate that to get to the bottom of it, and that happens in any instance.
And if you do, if you are in the country legally, what are you obligated to carry with you?
Well, that's a question I don't know the answer to. That's a good question. I'll know by next week.
We'll figure it out. Thank you, Chief. I appreciate your time, as always. All right, we'll take a break, come back, 8:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. It's 8:38, another Wednesday before Thanksgiving. That means time to talk to Justin Kennedy over at Parkway Po' Boys. How you doing, Justin?
I'm doing great, Tommy. I love being a regular on the show in November,
well,
man.
Well, we love having you on because it's all for a good cause. Tell me what's happening at Parkway today.
Yeah, so every Wednesday in November, we have today and next Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. We're doing our Thanksgiving Po' Boy. Everything made from scratch, from the dressing to the turkey to the gravy, all on Leinheimer French bread. And, you know, it draws a big line. People love it. It's like it's real rare. It's hard to get, so people get in line for it. And we developed a fundraiser with the Al Copeland Foundation. If you drop a $100 bill, you get to skip the line, and there is a line for sure. Mm-hmm. Skipping that line, you get the sandwich, you get a T-shirt, you get a chance to spin the wheel. It's like a Wheel of Fortune, but with all our sponsors, Blue Plate, Louisiane, Crystal Hot Sauce, Leinheimer, they all got swag, hats, shirts, prizes. Get a chance to spin that. You get a Hubick's Pie, the sweet potato edition. And all that $100 goes to fighting cancer. And that's pretty much it, you know. We've raised, the max we've ever raised is $40,000 in 4 days. And we're already there before we start. In a couple hours. So, and if you don't have the money to, you know, drop a $100 bill, you know, times are tough. If you just want to come in and buy a sandwich, if you want to wait in line, you can spend $5 to spin the wheel. There's all kind of ways you can donate, you know. So it's just a fun event. It's real festive. It's a vibe when you come here. It's really exciting. And, you know, this is a sandwich that is literally saving lives, you know, and that's first and foremost. You know, it is good, but everyone has tasted this because everyone eats Thanksgiving. Everybody knows good Thanksgiving meal, but the main thing, it's raising money to fight cancer.
And all homemade. I'll see you later with my $500 check, my friend. How do people find out more, Justin, if they want to donate?
You can go to parkwaypoorboys.com, hit the drop-down link, or alcopelandfoundation.org, and you can buy that skip-the-line ticket.
All for a good cause. All right, my friend. Thank you, Justin Kennedy over at Parkway Po' Boys. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, about what does the law say about deep fakes, AI images, like the mess they're having down in Lafourche Parish. We'll be back, WWL. 8:46, 14 till 9 last week. We talked to Alyssa Curtis about that stuff going on down in Lafourche Parish. You can imagine as a parent that your daughter, pictures of your daughter are being circulated by teenage boys that are not really nude pictures of her, but her face has been AI implanted or artificially put onto these. So for all intents and purposes, people think it is real. She swatted the phone out of the kid's hand. She got some disciplinary action. I'm giving you the quick details here. Dane Cialino joins us now, our friend, professor of law at Loyola, to talk about what the law has to say about deep fakes, Title IX, everything else. How you doing, Dane?
Just fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. What does the law say about, because here's the thing. If somebody takes a picture of me, I don't know why they would want to do this, but if they were to do that and then generate a nude photo of me, or not of me, but a nude photo and put my face on it, it's not really me other than my face. But what does the law say about all of this?
Yeah, it says a lot. I mean, this is an area where Congress, state legislatures, including the Louisiana legislature, and federal regulators under Title IX have been very active in the last couple of years. Deep fakes were something that no one heard about 3 or 4 years ago, and now we've got this this web of criminal and regulatory sanctions that exist for creating deep fakes. At the highest level, the federal criminal level, if somebody knowingly creates and then distributes an image of somebody who is identifiable in a deep fake, and it's an intimate image that includes nudity, sex acts, states of undress, whatnot, then there are potential federal criminal crimes that exist. Also, there are takedown provisions that require online platforms like Instagram or Facebook or X to remove images once they get a report of them, and to take reasonable efforts to prevent re-uploads of those sorts of things. So there's that level. Then, of course, the Louisiana legislature in 2023 also created a new crime, a state crime, that deals with unlawful deepfakes of minors, that sets fairly stringent hard labor penalties of 5 to 20 years in prison for doing these sorts of things. So, yeah, I mean, again, this is something that none of us heard of 3 or 4 years ago, and now we've got this criminal and regulatory framework to try to stop it.
Now, let me take a break. I want to talk about the civil aspects of this as well when we come back, if that's kept up with it or not, and has the law really kept up with all of this? A lot of people have questions about Title IX and what part that has in this, so we can discuss all of that when we come back with Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. Any questions, you can text him into 504-260-1870. Right now it's time for traffic on WWL. 8:56, 4 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, talking about this. You know, I can't imagine this father having a daughter, and you got AI-generated nude photos of your daughter. I don't even know how to phrase it, Dane, because it's your daughter's face. It's not her body, but still, nobody knows that to look at it. And we talked about the criminal protections against this and Title IX. What does Title IX have to do with this?
Well, Title IX applies in cases where any school or college gets federal financial assistance. And Title IX does define online harassment to include the non-consensual distribution of even AI-generated intimate images. If the image is severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, like this one clearly was, And Title IX obligates the school to take supportive measures and have a formal grievance process, investigate the claims of online harassment, et cetera. So yeah, Title IX is implicated, as well as we've already discussed, those federal and state criminal statutes.
So at what point does this become child porn? Because if it's a child's face on an adult body, you can't just say this is this or that. There has to be a law behind it, right? So does the law cover that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, if it's not a real child involved in the porn, then they certainly would have a defense that it's not child porn, but it certainly would still fall under these deep fake criminal statutes. Yeah, that's a good question. I think it would really depend on how much of the image is authentic.
And what about the civil portion of this, Dane? Can you be civilly liable for this? Or is it a thing where, you can get a judgment, but it's a wallpaper judgment because all you need is a phone and a little bit of, or a computer and a little bit of knowledge, and you can do this, and you have no assets?
Yeah, I mean, it's still tortious conduct that can lead to a regular civil tort suit in state court. That is certainly one of the options available to the family. If they can identify who did it and that it caused damages, then it would be an ordinary tort suit that would be viable.
So any final thoughts here, Dane, before we let you go? Anything I should have asked you?
No, again, very interesting topic and one that's continuing to evolve. And Everything's moving very quickly in this area, so the law is just trying to keep up.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. We take a break. We come back. I tried to ask you the top five permanent, problematic, persistent potholes in the area, and I was just besieged with answers, so I had to change it, and I'll tell you when I give you the survey results after the 9 o'clock hour. Plus, we'll talk with Alex Hammerstone about when you use a website or app to buy something, what happens to your data? How are they tracking it, and what do they do with it? Somebody texted in a question last week about facial recognition data and to establish their age for whatever reason, and what chances are that their picture could wind up somewhere, speaking with Dane Cialino, where they don't want it. And we'll talk to Bobby Hebert, you know who Bobby Hebert is. We'll talk about the Saints with him. So a lot coming up. Going to be a big 9 o'clock hour. Stay with us on this Wednesday morning, November 19th. Hopefully, the fog will burn off and we'll be back to normal. WWL. So we're getting ready to talk about with Alex Hammerstone about information and online and AI and all of that stuff. You hear this right here? You know what that is? That's me tearing a piece of paper out of a composition book, and upon these pages I write the answers to the survey every day, and I hand them, I walk in and I hand them to Ian Ozette while he's doing the news, and Joe Cardosi with the traffic, and Tim Zimmer so they can read the results with me. And I suddenly realized there's got to be a better way to do this, a more high-tech way to do this than me actually writing them out and carrying them to y'all, right? I mean, all right, let's keep it this way. We'll keep it this way. We're not going to change it. So I had been asking since 6 o'clock with our little cerebral survey that we do to give me the most permanent, persistent, pesky, problematic potholes in the city, and from the responses I got, there are far too many to name potholes. So instead, we had to do it by neighborhood, okay? So with that in mind, these are the answers that came in the top five as far as neighborhoods with the worst potholes. Number five, Holly Grove. Number four, Lake Vista. Number three, Algiers. You're not saying it right. Algiers. Tim, can you say it right or not?
Algiers.
There you go. That's right. Number two, Uptown. And number one, and this was, can y'all guess what number one was? Well, you have it in front of you. Would you have guessed otherwise? Would you have guessed this, Tim?
Oh, Kenner has some bad leg in potholes, I think.
Yeah, Kenner does, but this I think. Yeah, and at number one, Lakeview, definitely the worst, and all of Tullis Drive, and it's a mess. So thank you all for taking part in the survey. We'll have another one tomorrow. Thank you all for reading the results, and thanks to the people that made the composition book and the pen. Alex Hammerstone joins us, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. Talk about what happens when you use a website or an app to buy something. What happens to your data? Who's tracking it, and what do they do with it? How you doing, Alex?
I'm doing really well. How you been?
I'm okay. Somebody texted this in, so I'm going to get it out of the way. Apparently, they didn't have an LA wallet or whatever it is to verify their age, so the computer took a picture of them, and they want to know now, is their picture on the internet forever as a way to verify their age, or has, even though the text says the image was deleted, that is that image still out there? Once it's out there, is it out there? I guess the question.
So the answer, like many things, is it really depends, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, oftentimes when we use an image for age verification or identity verification, the agreement is that it will be deleted. There's kind of two pieces to that, though, right? One is, are they really doing that? You know, you have no way of proving that they deleted that image. Mm-hmm. And the second is, even if they try to delete it, you know, is it somehow still stored in memory or is it still somewhere out there? So the issue is there's really no guarantee that even if someone tells you something's going to be deleted, that it will be. So I think that's the challenge.
And I'm guessing, I don't know, I don't want to attribute any false motives to anybody, but I'm guessing this is maybe a site that they, you know, I don't know if you had to prove your age, I don't know what was going on there, but I'm not quite sure that that's a site that you want to be sharing, especially when you talk about AI-generated images, your picture with, right?
Well, I think a couple things, right? So there are a lot of things that require age verification, right? Maybe it's they're ordering alcohol or, you know, gambling sites or,
true.
Yeah. or there are other, you know, obviously other sites that you probably are thinking of as well. And the issue is when you think about a lot of those sites that are only for adults, believe it or not, they oftentimes have very strong security because they have to, and they make a lot of money, right? So they can afford to, and they know that they would have really significant business problems if they had a breach. So oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes those types of adult sites will have very strong security in place.
All right, let's talk about when you I saw somebody. I don't want to say anything wrong here because it could involve a lawyer, and I certainly don't want to get sued. But somebody, let's just say hypothetically, if I'm giving away something and I say, you know, I got this, all you got to do is
listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here, wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Come to DSW for the shoes, stay for the fun. Because, let's be honest, if shoe shopping isn't fun, are you even doing it right? So go ahead, try something new. Try something different. Good different. Try something that feels like you. You know, the real you. And then definitely brag about it later. Because at DSW, you've got unlimited freedom to play. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Is go to my website and sign up and you'll be eligible to win this. Even though I might not be soliciting people for the business, this is what I'm thinking of as I'm watching TV. Even though I'm not soliciting people directly for the business that I'm engaged in, I could have a side hustle here by collecting information or not.
So it depends, right? I hate to keep using that answer, but I think it's just that there's so many different ways it can happen. And data is extremely valuable, right? And so nothing in life is free. And there's an old saying that, you know, if something is free, you are the product, right? No one's giving things away. And people want to collect information, and information is valuable, and it's sold for multiple reasons, but usually to create a profile of shoppers and buyers that can then be sold to marketers or advertisers or retailers or whomever. So, you know, certainly when people are, you know, collect that information, it oftentimes is also for the information, not just to be able to give out a prize or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So once you do willingly give your information, I would presume that at some point with some entities, you're going through to make yourself eligible. At some point you're going through and you're clicking on an acceptance agreement. Pardon me.
So we would hope so, right? And so it's like, you know, if you think about a lot of the marketing calls you get, there's really two types, right? Some are legitimate, whether you want to receive them or not, and some are illegitimate. So some are, you know, large companies that have to follow the rules and do follow the rules and worry about getting fined. And then there are other ones that maybe are based overseas or, you know, just unscrupulous that don't follow the rules. And so that's really the same thing with websites. You know, if you're dealing with a large company or a household name, they tend to have contractual and legal requirements that they have to do certain things with data, and they have rules around it, and they tend to follow those rules. But there are also a lot of sites that, you know, operate without those rules. You know, they're not, you know, concerned about following them. They're not concerned about breaking the law and so on and so forth. And it can be very difficult for a consumer to discern which type of site you're dealing with.
Generally speaking, it's not really, you can't say, and again, it goes back to what you were saying about it all depends, but it's not really a bad thing, because I know a lot of times I have been surprised by the pop-up ads that I get, but I have wound up buying some of those things because it was of interest to me, right?
So, and that's always an argument, right? You know, there are a lot of people that don't want to be tracked, and I get that. I'm a big believer in kind of consent, so people should know what information they're sharing and why. But, you know, I'd much rather get targeted ads about things I might actually want to buy than things that aren't targeted. The other thing to remember, is we talk a lot about pop-up blockers or ad blockers or things like that, is, you know, right now, you know, we're talking on the radio, and that's a free medium because it's advertising supported. So if everybody blocked all the ads, what would happen? You know, you'd have to come up with a different kind of model, whether it's a subscription model or so on and so forth. So especially when it comes to media and journalism, a lot of that is advertising supported. And I think it's important for people to think about that, you know, whether or not you want to be tracked. You know, if you're not willing to see advertising, then you're going to have to pay a fee to receive these services.
Well, I'm going to have to let you go, Alex, because I'm going to go answer this text that I'm kidding about that. I'm going to answer this text that I got. Apparently, they're recruiting me for this job that, you know, looks pretty good. $3,000 an hour working from home. How do they get that information? Is that a result of something that I signed up for, or is it a result as a spam call pops up on a request line? Or is that something that they just, for whatever reason, wherever this place is, they just start sending out job offers, and then I've never responded to these. What's the other side of this? Is anybody, do you know anybody's ever responded to them, or any research that's been done into these job offer scams?
So unfortunately, I do know people that have responded, you know, and they're almost always a scam. There's a number of different ways those, you know, resume or job texts are scams. And the issue is once they have your data, you know, they'll either do something with that data, or they'll try to get you to pay an application fee, or, you know, they'll do a check scam where they'll say that, you know, you have the job and we're going to send you equipment, but you need to send us a check for it. Or there's multiple ways that happens. And the reason you receive it, it may be that at some point you give out your number, but the issue is there are only so many phone numbers out there, right? And, you know, you can, with a computer, come up with a list of every phone number in existence, and it's pretty cheap to, you know, then send these texts to every number. And, you know, over time, they kind of start to understand which numbers are active and which aren't and which ones are real, and create lists that the scammers will share. So they have a pretty good idea of which numbers are live, and they'll just cast a very wide net. And if you send out 3 or 4 of those messages, you might not get any results. But if you send out 100,000, the law of averages, you're going to find a lot of people that fall for it.
So does AI help these people in a way? Because it's all about crunching numbers, right? Create combinations of numbers where they can now, because of AI, and would that lead to the increase in the spam calls that we're getting, where they're now able to generate all the numbers that exist?
So it absolutely can be helpful in a number of ways. You know, AI can support a lot of scams. And, you know, one is generating the numbers. You know, that's a pretty easy task for modern computers, right? So they don't necessarily need AI. But what AI is very good at is taking large quantities of data and then doing something with it, right? So aggregating it. And it makes it easier to sort things. But the other thing with AI is it can help create scripts. So one of the things that, you know, we've been told for years, right, is that when you get these scam texts or phishing emails, they oftentimes are poorly written, you know, written like somebody that, you know, isn't necessarily a native speaker of English, and to look out for those things. But with AI, they're able to create much better scripts, much better emails, much better texts, and things like that. So it supports the scammers in that way as well.
So is this ever going to go away? Is this going to continue to get worse?
I think, you know, we can go back thousands of years, right? And people were scamming each other.
But I meant specifically the volume of these job offers and the spam calls, because, man, I get tired of it. I know a lot of people do. And let me take a break. I just realized the time. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. And is there any way to insulate yourself from this? Because I don't know of any way that there is, and I really hate when I'm driving and I can't identify the number, so I will answer the phone thinking it might be a client or a business thing or whatever, or personal, and then it turns out to be one of these idiotic things. Alex Hammerstone's our guest, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. If you have any questions or comments about internet safety, security, scams, text them in to 504-260-1870. I will not keep your information, but I will pass your question along when we come back on WWL. Got a false start there at 927. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec, about internet scams and what people do with the information, etc. Somebody texted in and said they unsubscribe from emails. Does that really unsubscribe me, or does that just verify that I have a live email? That's an interesting question, like a hall of mirrors.
It's another one of those depends, right? So if it's a legitimate company sending you these emails, you know, they're going to follow the law, right? Mm-hmm. So if it's, a major company or a store that you're familiar with, they're going to unsubscribe you. Now, one thing to keep in mind is oftentimes you'll end up having signed up for 10 different email lists from the same company, and you may only be unsubscribing from one of those. But an unscrupulous company that's, sending spam emails anyway is not going to unsubscribe you. And, responding may let them know that you have a live email address.
So, you remember David Letterman with his top 10 lists?
Of course.
I always thought that it would be a good top 10 list to be either punchlines to jokes or unsolicited texts that people send you to get you to respond. You know, they send you these messages, and you're supposed to, I guess, say what, for example, you get a text that pops up, says, yeah, but this one's eating my popcorn. Another one says, mom's on a roof, won't come down. You get a third one that says, whatever you do, don't pick a cantaloupe, those kind of things. So when you reply with, or not reply, but when you hit delete and report as junk, does anybody pay any attention to that? Or is that just an exercise that you do to make you feel better about yourself?
So if you report it as junk, it does get aggregated, right? So if a lot of people are reporting the same number as junk, that usually will end up on some kind of spam list or so forth. Obviously deleting any unsolicited text messages is important. Don't reply to it. The new thing, as you mentioned, is kind of these random texts that say, hey, are you going to be here for dinner? Or, right, what are you doing tonight? And the hope is that you'll think, oh, somebody sent that, by mistake. So you reply and say, hey, this seems like a wrong number text. And then they'll start some kind of conversation and try to scam you from there.
So just responding in and of itself is a good idea or a bad idea?
It's a bad idea for those. You just kind of want to let those kind of slide.
But if you slide or hit report as junk and unsubscribe, that's not the same as responding, right?
That's correct. Okay. That's not responding. That's kind of sending the notification to the carrier or to the to your phone company.
Is this any different, somebody texted in, really, than direct mail pieces? Because I tried to game the direct mail system just to see who was watching what with what list by changing names and responding to this ad or that ad. And I did it deliberately to see who would respond by, or what list I got on by responding to ads that included address labels. Alex, I kid you not, I have an entire hefty container full of address labels now with junk mail that I get from people that apparently sell lists. So is it the same kind of thing where, just like with direct mail pieces, they share lists about what people respond to, the same thing here or not? Or is it individual actors?
Absolutely. And so not only do kind of legitimate companies and marketing companies share these lists and sell your data and, sell lists of who's interested in what, also there's a whole underground economy of it too, right? Where, these things are sold and shared by unscrupulous, marketers and scammers and hackers and everybody else. So there really are kind of two economies there. So certainly, it's, when you think about it, right, when you go to the grocery store, you scan your little card and, they see that you buy one brand of hot dogs. Well, they'll sell that list so that another brand of hot dogs can send you a coupon. Mm-hmm. That's been going on forever. So these lists have always been sold and aggregated and shared, and it's a big income stream. A lot of companies that you think are just selling a product actually make more money by selling data.
It's been going on for a long, long time. Somebody wants to know if one computer or phone is safer than the other. If you're talking about Android or Google phone, the one with the vanilla ice cream, I'm still not quite sure what they're selling on that one. But or about different browsers, are there browsers that you can use or not? And then somebody else wants to know, and I think it kind of piggybacks on this, about cookies. When they ask you to accept cookies, only necessary cookies, no cookies, what do you do?
Well, so to the phone piece, the most important thing, and I'm not evading the question because there's kind of a lot of debate on what's most secure, but the most important piece is whatever you have, keep it updated, right? So when Apple or Android is sending out a security update, there's a reason for that. So make sure you keep your phone and your browser and your computer
updated. So wait, let me jump in for a second. So when that happens, that means that, in essence, they're saying, okay, the program didn't account for this. Somebody found a way to that. Or is it can it sometimes be, we found a way to make this better, we're going to give you an extra feature?
So both. Okay. But if it's a security update, it's generally marked as that, right? So when you get one of these updates for your phone to install, it usually will tell you why. It'll say, hey, we've added new features, which you probably don't want. Mm-hmm. Or this is a security update. And the security updates are generally because they've discovered something that's a security risk and are issuing a patch to fix that.
But are they finding out things about you when you get the update?
And generally, they already know, right? I mean, but updating, your software is generally not going to provide any more of your personal information to anyone. I always strongly encourage people to update their phones, their computers, their browsers, everything else.
Somebody wants to know about browsing history. Does it matter if you delete your browsing history? It matters if you want the people that you share a computer with to know what you're browsing. But what about in terms of being tracked or people violating your privacy online, et cetera?
It's one of those things. I mean, it can help, right? The more you're removing information. But your browsing history, if you're talking about what's stored on your own computer, as you mentioned, right, if you share a computer with somebody, deleting that, they can't see where you were, at least not easily. But as far as, deleting it from, the sites you visit, that's much more difficult, right? I mean, there's certain laws like in Europe and things like that and certain privacy laws where you can request that your data is deleted, but that's a kind of a labor-intensive process.
So,
go ahead.
No, finish up.
But the data's really out there. I mean, for a lot of us listening, we've been online for 10, 20, 30 years. And, in all that time, these, large dossiers about us and our buying habits and our interests and everything else and our demographics are already out there and built. And it's really hard to kind of, put that back in the barn.
So are cookies necessarily bad?
Not necessarily. They're kind of two types, right? There's first party, which is installed by the site you're visiting, and then third party, which track you across different sites. When it comes to, especially first party, they can be very helpful, right? Because it's the reason that a link shows up a different color if you've already clicked on it. Mm-hmm. It's a reason that your shopping cart kind of remains on that site with the things that you put in there, even if you kind of left the site and come back. So it can be very helpful in those ways. But certainly, the others that may track you across sites can be a cause for concern for a lot of people.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate the time and the information as always. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. We'll come back, talk to the one and only Bobby Hebert, the Cajun Cannon, 9:35, 25 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10. One of my favorite things about having this job is having sat in a dome for 14 years in Section 325 with a belly full of beer and thinking I knew what I was looking at, watching Bobby Hebert play with Dalton Hilliard and all the guys, and now I get to call him a friend and talk to him and find out I didn't know what the hell I was talking about at all. With that, we welcome in the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert. How you doing, Bobby?
I'm doing awesome, Tommy. I'll tell you what, I'm looking for an optimistic second half post buys winning streak.
Bro, let me tell you something. Let me tell you. And I feel the same way. And I told Mike Dettillier this yesterday and before the season. They make these bets about how many wins or loses. I think that's a sucker's bet because you have no idea what injuries are going to do. You have no idea what shape the other team's going to be when you play them. And with all that being said, I share your optimism for the rest of the season. Go ahead. I'm going to shut up and listen to you.
Yeah, well, look, it does matter when you play a team. I think we catch in Atlanta at the right time to have their top receiver and their starting quarterback out. And now they have one of the best running backs in the NFL, Bijan Robinson. But look at Carolina's running game, how we stuff them. So can we build upon that and force Kirk Cousins to beat us? He's not, you know, we've had trouble with mobile quarterbacks, but he's going to stay in the pocket. So, no, I think it's a great opportunity. I think this does make a difference. You look at the Saints, you know, have the easiest strength of schedule remaining. When you look at their opponents, have a combined winning percentage of like 34%. Mm-hmm. Well, what they're probably saying also, but Bobby, they're saying that, oh, that's a win for us against the Saints. Well, I don't know, flip a coin, whatever, but that's positive. You know, we're still right there in the NFC. Look, when you look at wins, okay, where are we at? We still have one of the league's worst records at 2-8. Mm-hmm. But you have to look at when you play a team and how it occurs. And when I look at it right now, over the final 7 weeks, five of the opponents are records under 500. And then you always got to win within the division. You know, you're going to play, you still got to play Atlanta twice, still got to play Tampa Bay, and you got to play Carolina again. So, you know, you always say first things first, we got to win within the division. So four division games right there, I think you could throw out the records when that occurs. Now, and then you look at, okay, who are you playing that you're not familiar with? Well, two teams on pace to pick in the top five next year's draft. Look at the Titans and Jets. I think the Dolphins have gotten a little better. You know, when I look at that, they're kind of, you know, which Dolphin team are you going to get? They're on that roller coaster with Titans and Jets. No, it's very favorable for the Saints. And I thought this, Tommy, when I draft and then OTAs and minicamp, I said I think they have basically the same schedule, same record as they had last year. I was looking more like 5 or 6 wins.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I saw the offensive line in training camp, I said, oh, I don't know. I'm thinking more 4 or 5. And still, that should be the strength of the team, which it is not. And you could see that they busted on Trevor Penning, drafted him in the first round.
Bobby, let me jump in 1 second because they just told me the southbound causeway is closed because of fog.
Okay.
All right, I just wanted to get that out there. Southbound causeway closed. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I actually got to go do an appearance on the North Shore, but I'm heading north, so that might hopefully, I'll be able to make it.
I don't understand how you would think the fog would affect both sides of the causeway the same, right?
Well, I guess they do that convoy, and then
they're setting up cones southbound. They're setting up cones, they tell me, and it'll take 15 minutes, so there you go.
Okay, yeah, you do a convoy in both ways. And,
all right, so go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then so you look at very favorable, and people don't realize now we don't know how teams are going to turn out. Look, New England, no one thought they're kind of could be the number one seed in the AFC. You know, that's for sure going to be the Bills. You never know.
Nope.
But I tell you what, I saw the Rams in training camp. I'm like, well, if Matthew Stafford's playing, no, the Rams definitely could be amongst the best. But just look at the teams that we lost at the beginning. I mean, the Patriots are 9-2. The Rams are 8-2. The Seahawks, 7-3. They're amongst the league's best. Then you look at the Bears.
Right.
Now, that's a real good story. They're 7-3. Now, Tampa Bay kind of, you know, they're winning those close games. Not so much right now. They sit atop the NFC South, but they're only 6-4. Then you look at the 49ers, all the injuries they've dealt with. They're 7-4. The Bills, like I said, the Patriots are one game up on them. They're in the playoff chase, 7-3. So if you look at it, of the Saints' 8 losses this season, only one defeat has been by a team currently under 500. And I thought we should have won that game. Juwan Johnson makes a great catch against the Cardinals. You know, look at the Cardinals, that season opener, they're 3-7.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just telling you, it doesn't matter because their fan base, the opponents on the back end of the season, so, we can have a win against the Saints. Well, no, I think as Saints fans, we just say we should be able to take advantage against a team like the Titans and Jets. And then, obviously, a division opponent in Atlanta.
Well, let's talk about the obvious difference between the Saints' offense going into the second half of the season as opposed to the first half of the season, other than the Carolina Panthers game or the Rams' second half, I guess. I'm talking about Tyler Shough.
Well, yeah. When I was impressed with on Tyler Shough, was his pocket presence and what he did on third down. He threw for like over 200 yards of his passing yards was on third down. And that's when, you know, first down, Saints, you're moving the chains, you're dictating the ebb and flow of the game. No, you have a great opportunity to win. Now, and obviously, if you could take the ball away and you protect it, Tommy, this is what's going to happen with Shuck. If Tyler Shuck plays like he played against Carolina the rest of the season, whether we win or lose, so let's say he has a Carolina-type game and we lose a tough one. That doesn't matter. They say that he leads us to victory, plays like Carolina. Ooh, that you chalk one up. What you don't want to happen is the Saints win, and they didn't win because of Tyler Shuck.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Tyler Shuck didn't play too good, but we still won. Well, then you still, I don't know about the future quarterback.
You see, that's interesting. What you're saying is for the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 games, right?
Yeah.
If he plays well, that's going to bode well for next season, whether you win or lose or not. If you run a table, exactly. Finish 9-8, that's great, but it all depends on why you lose the game, right?
Yes, he can't be the reason why we lost, and he has to be the reason why we're winning, or a big part of it. So we have like Drake May. You don't think he makes the difference why the Patriots are winning? So I think that's kind of wait and see. You know, slow your roll. I'm highly optimistic on Tyler Shuck.
But I want to talk to you about Tyler Shuck. I want to talk to you about that because I can listen to somebody on the radio. After doing this for so long, I know what they're doing, what they're not doing, what they did, what they didn't do. You played professional football how many years? 14, 15, 16?
I played kind of in USFL. I was 15.
15 years. Tell me what, as a quarterback, a professional quarterback, what did you see from Tyler Shuck in terms of proving that he knew what he was doing or that he had the ability?
Just on third down, the money down. Now, if he continues to do that and his pocket presence, you know, it's good that you could scramble and make plays with your feet, but it's better to make plays with your feet but keep your eyes, you know, downfield and throw it to the playmakers. And it's good you can run now and then, but people think you got to panic. You never want to be running backwards. The NFL is too good. Shedeur Sanders, they all know that. Even Caleb Williams has to learn with the Bears. So you're not going to accomplish anything running around and ad-libbing going backwards. You got to be going forward. Now, Lamar Jackson gets away with it now and then, but you have to play the percentages. So I think with Tyler Shuck, his pocket presence there, you don't have to move that far. I mean, because offensive line can be pushing on a defensive line. You can't freak out. You got to be able to step up in the pocket and extend the play and then make plays. Because you don't have to really move that far. You think, you got to move 2 or 3 yards or whatever. No, it could be like a half a yard. It's just a few feet, and now he's a big guy, a strong guy. They might be touching you, but they're falling off of you. They're not getting you down, and you're still able to make plays in the pocket. So that's what I've been impressed with, his pocket presence, how you handle adversity. I mean, he's not going to go against a tougher team than that Rams defense. Mm-hmm. His first game, he's going against the Rams, one of the best teams in the NFC. And so it's like, whoa. So, you know, how you handle adversity. So you go from there. Now, Tommy, another thing, he's played 2 games in the road. He hasn't played in the Superdome.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of guilty of this where I didn't mind playing on the road. You know, we were winning 10, 11, 12 games, for 4 seasons. I didn't mind playing on the road because it's like almost a mentality, us against the world. And so you could be kind of footloose, fancy free. And sometimes when you play at home, hopefully this is not the case, you want to play so well and you want to have a great showing that maybe that you're pressing. And, it would be his first home game in the Superdome and ironic against the dreaded rival in the Falcons. So I just hope he has a good showing. But again, in theory, if you still want a high draft pick, if you're going to play that game, I don't want us to win. I want us to still be in the top five. Okay, and this is what you'd want. You can rebuild the team faster if this would happen. Tyler Shuck plays awesome the rest of the season, and we might lose some hard-fought battles, but we still pick it in the top five. Then you can rebuild your other position on the team and have that turn around quicker rather than say, we still don't have our quarterback and we got to go find one.
Thank you, Bobby. I could talk to you for 9 hours. You know that. I appreciate the time you gave us. Thank you, sir. Be careful going across the causeway. 954, 6 till 10. Traffic now, WWL.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Looking for a new way to grow your business? With TikTok for Business, anything is possible. If you've ever thought about advertising on TikTok, now's the time to do it. You can drive more customers to your website, sell products right in the app, and you can even use TikTok's creative tools to easily make content and find creators to help sell your products for you. Find new customers today. Just open your browser, type in getstarted.tiktok.com/tiktokads, and grow your business fast.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit DetectTheSOS.com today to learn more.